From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. Just ahead on the show this hour, we're looking at the generational aspects of the COVID-19 pandemic, your age and what that means in this moment. The effects of this global issue vary in some ways from age group to age group. Coming up, we'll be joined by several award-winning journalists from throughout the U.S. and a Sacramento-based psychologist who can talk about some of the potential long-term effects facing children of the COVID generation. Let's turn now to our big conversation of the day, COVID-19 through the eyes of different generations. First up, multi-generational living. As a state, at roughly 8%, California has the second highest rate of families with more than one generation living under one roof. Only Hawaii has a higher rate. And this mixing of generations all in the same house may have some consequences when it comes to COVID-19. CalMatters Health and Social Services reporter Elizabeth Aguilera joins us now to talk about this. Her recent article, The Virus and the Vulnerable, looks at why Latino children suffer from higher rates of COVID-19. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Hi, Randall.
Yeah, so let's start with the findings that Latino children are testing positive for the virus at higher rates than other groups of children.
Right. So Latino children are accounting for 68% of the cases where the state knows race and ethnicity. So there's still thousands more children where they don't know, and experts suspect that many of those children are also Latino. That right now is about more than 15,000 Latino children in the state who have tested positive. That's according to the California Department of Public Health. So there's been a lot of attention on why this is happening among this particular group, because among other children, the rates are much, much lower.
And we know that children, Elizabeth, don't often suffer from COVID-19 the way older generations do, but that doesn't mean that there isn't a risk factor here. There can be other complications.
That's right. So the pediatricians that I spoke with said, you know, most kids, thankfully, don't get seriously ill. They show modest symptoms or no symptoms at all. Some of the families I spoke with said, you know, their child had a cough, but not a fever. Some do end up in the hospital, but not that many. And we've had no deaths in California among children. Some other states have, and so pediatricians do worry that could be coming if the numbers continue to rise. But the complication that doctors talk about and worry about is this new rare post-infection multi-system inflammatory syndrome. That's what they're calling it. And it shows up about 3 to 4 weeks after kids have had an infection of coronavirus. And they're landing in the hospital. You know, it's very similar to another post-inflammatory, post-infection disease called Kawasaki disease.
Right.
But they're connecting it to coronavirus. And if it's not treated quickly enough, it could impact their heart, multiple organs. So doctors are concerned about that. While it's rare, if we see more coronavirus cases, they will see more kids with the syndrome.
And then another part of the problem is that, you know, these children aren't living in an isolated situation. They're living in a house that's often crowded with multi-generations of family members there. So that really presents a problem.
Right. In this case, it definitely does. And you mentioned that California has a high rate of families who live in this situation. And Latinos, particularly for cultural reasons and also for affordability reasons, especially here in California, live in multi-generational or multi-family housing. So you have kids in the house with not only their own parents, but grandparents or maybe aunts and uncles, or even separate, you know, other families where they're sharing housing. So if someone gets sick, you know, the kids are exposed, and then it's also hard to isolate in a situation like that.
And we're talking about, you know, dinner time where everyone's around the table and things like that. Is it possible to isolate in these conditions? Can, you know, can grandma have her own space in a certain part of the house?
You know, families try, but I think it's very difficult. The doctors I spoke with say, you know, there is nowhere for someone who is either exposed or infected to hide out in a way, or to stay separate from the rest of the family. I spoke with one family where the dad was positive first, and he slept in the living room, and the mom and four children slept in the bedroom. But when you have a one bedroom apartment, that's really tough to do. And the family, you know, one of the children did end up testing positive as well.
And you mentioned the one family that you followed there. Latinos are more likely to be essential workers, right? And that's where these cases develop?
That's right. So that is the main exposure for Latino children that the experts I spoke with pointed to. You know, Latinos work in low-paying fields that require you to be there, right? So they're working service jobs, restaurant jobs, farm jobs, factories, healthcare jobs. They have to be on site. They don't get to work from home. And then they come home to the crowded conditions that we were just talking about. Families sharing, you know, lots of family members sharing common space. And so they're the main exposure for the children is the essential workers. There was a study in San Francisco conducted by UCSF and community groups that found this same thing. They said Latinos accounted for nearly all of the infections they found among the people they studied, and most of them could not work from home.
Currently, some of the state's highest infection rates and hospitalization rates are in farm communities. We've got San Joaquin County, Stanislaus County, Merced County, Colusa. These are all places, you know, where agriculture is king. And as you just mentioned, it's many of those workers that are, you know, jammed into transportation buses and that sort of thing, working shoulder to shoulder in the fields.
Right. And they're also not always given the protection that they need, whether it's in the farm fields or in factories. At least until recently, people were not talking about PPE on the job site. So people use, you know, they try their best on their own, but they're still very worried about bringing whatever home to their families, not just the children, but also, you know, the elderly grandparents who might live with them too.
Elizabeth, how about COVID-19 messaging for a, you know, Spanish-speaking population here in California?
The state and the counties have all, you know, put out information in Spanish through advertising on radio and TV, through billboards, and the pediatricians are talking to their families about this as well. But I think the challenge is that when people have to go to work, and if they're not afforded the protections, then they're still having this challenge of bringing that home. So I think there's more discussion now about how do you protect yourself while you're at work? How do you protect yourself when you're out, you know, running the errands, as many of the workers in these families are the folks who run the errands as well. So it's reaching that level. And I know some counties, I spoke with Riverside County, they're going to they're upping their efforts to reach people in this way too, because they're seeing the numbers and are concerned about these families.
So we've established that these families are seeing higher rates of the disease, but yet they also lack health care coverage at higher rates as well.
Right. Some folks in the Latino community don't have any coverage or rely on community clinics, nonprofit type offerings for healthcare. But even those who do have healthcare, like many of the children are covered through Medi-Cal, but they find that it's difficult to access, or they have to wait a long time for an appointment because there are not enough physicians registered with Medi-Cal, which is, of course, a whole other conversation. But yeah, they don't, you know, the access is difficult. And often because there might be fear about accessing healthcare, they don't take advantage of it or don't know how to do that. And so there's also some outreach to let people know they can get tested and, you know, trying to figure out what to do about treatment as well.
CalMatters Health and Social Services reporter Elizabeth Aguilera on multi-generational living and its tie to COVID-19. Thank you so much for joining us today, Elizabeth.
Thanks, Randall.
Up next, we're speaking with a psychologist about the potential long-term effects of growing up as a child in the COVID generation. Also, for those who survived the AIDS pandemic in the 1980s and 90s, this is not their first time facing death due to a virus that is little understood. How the AIDS generation is handling COVID-19 with award-winning journalist Hank Plant. And then later, Gen Zers and millennials, listen up. A journalist with the New York Times joins us to talk about dating during a pandemic. I'm your host, Randall White. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. And the big conversation of the day on this Wednesday is COVID-19 and how it may be affecting you based on your generation. The youngest among us, especially those at key developmental stages of learning how to socialize could see long-lasting effects. Licensed clinical psychologist at the UC Davis Mind Institute and assistant clinical professor in the Department of Pediatrics, Dr. Brianna Winder Patel, joins us now to dig deep into this aspect. Thanks for being with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
So the pandemic is obviously impacting millions of children, many of whom are in those key developmental stages in their lives. What are some of the key areas where psychologists are concerned that the current situation could cause some permanent negative changes to their emotional growth?
Well, I think it's a lot about the experience that the parents and the adults around them kind of convey to them about this. This is uncertain for all of us. And, you know, most of us have never gone through something quite like this in our lives. And children really take their prompts from those adults around them. So if there's a lot of stress and tension in their lives right now, without some other side of that to try to, you know, help with their resiliency, there could be some negative effects, but there's also a potential for some positive things to come out of this.
I was wondering if down the line we might see, post-pandemic, we might see an increased personal space bubble. You know, so in the U.S. prior to the pandemic, we had, a couple of feet of space seemed normal. You go to some Scandinavian countries, it might be a little farther away. Some other countries, a little closer. But, you know, these children, as they're learning what's a safe distance to be from someone when they're in their 20s and 30s, 6 feet.
Yeah. So I think it depends on the person. I personally enjoy a hefty amount of personal space. So the non-huggers among us are thriving right now, but there are some people that really struggle with this. And I think the message for children is that, you know, most people don't really totally understand what 6 feet away is. And this is even harder for kids. So it's, again, how we present it to them that, you know, in very concrete, plain language, we're trying to stay a little farther from people so that we don't pass our germs. And probably most kids need to see a visual. So they probably need to know that if you stand in the middle and you draw a circle 6 feet away with sidewalk chalk, that's what the expectation is. It's more of a concern that if they're getting yelled at a lot for not observing this, or there's a lot of stress and tension about, you know, where they're keeping their bodies, that's going to probably make them feel bad. But kids are adaptive and they're resilient. And if we reinforce them for their flexibility and do this with, you know, kindness, that I don't know that this will give any kind of lasting thing. It's more of if they leave this thinking, I get yelled at every time I go within 4 feet of someone, that's going to be more of the concern.
Right. We always hear about children's brains being like a sponge. And I just recall when I was about 10, California had a really severe drought. And we were, as you just said, yelled at, you know, if we left the water running, there were, you know, shorter showers, different types of shower heads, all that kind of stuff. And that has carried through my life, even moving to areas of the country where I could, you know, essentially use all the water I wanted. I still swapped out the shower head and I find myself being a water monitor wherever I am. So there could be elements like this that carry through a child's life.
Yeah, there could be. And I think if you say it to them in a calm way, you remind them, maybe do that whole visual thing with how far is 6 feet, and then take a picture of it as a kind reminder that, that it's just kind of how the way you present it. We used to teach kids all the time, personal space was an arm's length away. So, you know, you imagine how short many children's arms are. Like, this is a big difference, and they need to understand the expectation, but then it takes a long time to change behavior. So if you're 10 years old and you're used to standing 1 feet from your classmates, you can't expect them to just do this overnight. So kind of the kindness, I understand this is new, this is hard. You're really doing great with being flexible with this, and rewarding the effort can, you know, make it so that your lasting memories aren't the negative ones.
We are hearing so much right now about how schools will reopen in the coming weeks. And so you know, most children will likely be in a distance learning situation for the foreseeable future. What kind of impact might that have?
Yeah, so I really think it depends on the way the program is set up. I've in my clinic, I've heard from many patients that they're muted and their videos are off, at least their experience in the spring. And I think that's very different from a Zoom setup where you can see your classmates and you can answer questions. I know this is a huge challenge for schools, but how can you replicate this distance learning in a way most similar to what we would have in the classroom? When the videos are off and they're muted the whole time, it kind of allows for the avoidance of the social situation and disengagement. And we want to do everything we can to try to foster that similar situation, including group breakouts, which are possible over some of these, you know, virtual learning setups like Zoom. And then thinking about outside of school, how it can be still physical distancing and not social distancing. So what can happen within families to still keep social interaction happening, even though we can't be in person in the same way?
Brianna, I don't want to only focus on negative aspects of this, because there could be some positive effects, right, on children growing up in this situation, like being closer to families because they're spending a lot of their time at home.
Yeah. So I think there is a balance there in that the stress levels in some families are higher than they've ever been. So there's a lot of tension, and you know that there's a lot of things people are handling right now that are new and unexpected. I think there's a way to kind of balance that out with being able to, one example is modeling coping strategies for kids. If you are, as a parent, very, very stressed out and you feel like you're kind of going to explode, and you can say, you know, I'm feeling pretty stressed out right now. I think I'm going to make a helpful choice and I'm going to sit and listen to my music for 5 minutes, or I'm going to, you know, walk around the neighborhood. Would you like to go with me? So modeling those coping skills can be a way to, you know, help your children do it, but also monitor the stress of yourself. And also, you know, I think some parents have a concern that they're supposed to be doing these like elaborate craft and art projects every day, and they're supposed to make it this like little utopia at home. And I think it's just not really that realistic to be doing that for everyone. Right. But there's small things that can make an impact, like saying at the end of the day, you know, having a book, what was your favorite family memory from today? Oh, daddy danced really funny today. Or, you know, little things that can make an impact when you do it every day. It kind of builds up over time, but in that day, it's not a lot. So I think some families can get closer. I think it's that whole topic of we have a lot of stress, but how do we manage the stress ourselves so that our children don't leave the situation feeling like it was just one big ball of tension.
And just briefly moving back to school again, not all children learn the same way. So there might be a segment of children that actually learn better under this distance learning, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think that some like the flexibility more. They're very independent learners. They're able to do that. And they sort of enjoy having a little more, you know, control over when they do their assignments, as long as it gets done. I think that's the case for some. I'm more so hearing the other side that it's, you know, it's new and it's very different. So it's challenging.
Licensed clinical psychologist at the UC Davis Mind Institute and assistant clinical professor in the Department of Pediatrics, Dr. Brianna Winder Patel. Thank you for sharing that insight into children growing up in this pandemic.
Thank you.
Let's skip ahead a couple, or even, I guess, a few generations to those who lived through the last great pandemic, one that took an exceptionally high toll on the population of gay men living during the 1980s and 90s. Acquired immune deficiency syndrome, or AIDS, is caused by HIV. You know, much like COVID-19 is caused by novel coronavirus, or SARS-CoV-2, as it's known in more scientific circles. And like the current disease, little was known about AIDS when it first started sweeping through gay communities in North America, including one major hotspot, San Francisco. At the time, journalist Hank Plant was a reporter for KPIX, San Francisco's CBS affiliate, and covered the pandemic. He's here now to give us some insight into the perspectives of survivors of the AIDS generation and how they view the current pandemic. Hank, it is a pleasure to have you on the show.
Oh, Randall, nice to see you. Nice to be with you. I appreciate it.
Last time I saw you, you were passing in a pride parade, and I was texting you from the balcony of my hotel in Palm Springs. So,
yeah, I live in Palm Springs now after that long career in San Francisco. And you know, it's interesting what you were saying in your intro, which was spot on. This COVID epidemic brings back so many painful memories for people who are living with HIV. We have something like 10 to 15,000 people with HIV here in the Coachella Valley where I live. And a lot of them have compromised immune systems. So they are vulnerable to COVID-19. And this brings back so many painful memories of that first pandemic.
Right. I'm wondering, Hank, what the conversation was like in your newsroom back in the mid 80s when it came to covering the AIDS crisis. Were journalists afraid to, you know, get in too deep, get too close to some of these people who were suffering symptoms? How did the newsroom handle it?
Yes, many were. I was, as you know, one of the first openly gay TV reporters in the country. So I knew what the do's and don'ts were as far as transmission back then and the fact that it was not easily spread. So I didn't have any personal fear. There was a TV station in San Francisco, not mine, but another one, where photographers refused to enter the rooms of patients to shoot an interview. Photographer would stand in the hallway, shoot through the door, and the reporter had to go in and use a stick microphone rather than a clip-on lavalier microphone. So there was a lot of trepidation among journalists. Look, it was very similar to what we're seeing here today. I mean, picture this scenario, Randall. A strange disease comes out of nowhere. Nobody knows where it came from. Nobody knows how it spread. We have politicians didn't care about it. We had a president who was slow to act on it. And then we had this group of heroes, healthcare workers. They showed up, they did their job, not knowing if they were risking their lives, not knowing if they were bringing it home to their own families. So there are so many similarities to those times and these times.
There really are, now that you draw that, including misinformation about how it might be spread, We didn't have Facebook and Twitter back then, so some of that information didn't spread as quickly. How did it spread? Where would people get their information aside from watching your reports?
Well, the government wasn't talking. The Reagan administration wasn't talking. There were a few of us in the media, my station I'm very proud of, KPIX, who were going on the air every night and telling people what's the latest with the disease, including how to not get it. What's new on the drug scene? New York Times and the LA Times and the San Francisco Chronicle were doing a good job, but it was tough to get information. You know, one of the things that's interesting to me now, Randall, is if you look at the politicians who I think are doing the best job handling COVID, they all came out of that era. And so they knew from that pandemic to take this thing seriously in the beginning. You look at Governor Gavin Newsom, who was born and raised in the Bay Area and came out of the AIDS era. And you look at Jeff Koors, who was our mayor here in Palm Springs, John DiAmico, the mayor of West Hollywood. All of these people knew to take this very, very seriously early on. And I think a big part of that is because of their experience living with and in some cases dealing with the AIDS epidemic.
And that would include Dr. Anthony Fauci, right?
Absolutely. You know, I had Fauci on speed dial at one point. I mean, this guy is a hero, and he has dealt with so many epidemics, including SARS and Ebola. No wonder he was given the Presidential Medal of Freedom. I mean, and he is a straight shooter. We're so lucky to have him. He's 79 years old, still doing this. We're so lucky to have him.
A dozen years ago or so, the two of us were in San Diego for a journalism convention. And at one event, you were interviewing the now late Larry Kramer, an AIDS activist and founder of ACT UP. I was running around like a Phil Donahue getting audience questions for you. Kramer passed less than 2 months ago, and he famously battled with Dr. Fauci during the AIDS crisis. Do you know if he shared any perspectives on COVID-19 before his passing?
I don't know the answer to that. I know that they did patch things up. Fauci recently talked about Larry Kramer. He said, first time I ever heard of Larry Kramer, he called me a murderer on the front page of the newspaper. They did patch things up, and I know that they respected each other.
Yeah. Hey, I want to mention you were featured in a documentary called 5B about the first AIDS hospital ward in the nation at San Francisco General. And that was honored last year at the Cannes Film Festival. Tell me a little bit about the making of that film and, you know, having it get such praise at Cannes.
I'm so proud of that. Thank you for mentioning that. And let me tell people, it's on Amazon Prime. So if you're a subscriber, you can see it for free on Amazon Prime. It's called 5B, B as in boy. And that was, as Randall says, that was the first AIDS ward in the nation at San Francisco General. And if you want to see a portrait of nurses who were heroes, that's the film to watch. They interviewed me because I was the reporter covering that ward and the rest of the epidemic since the beginning. And it really, that documentary really took off. And we were invited to Cannes Film Festival. We got a standing ovation. We won the Cannes Lions Award. It was one of the most exciting moments of my life. I mean, right behind us on the red carpet was Elton John and his crew because they were premiering Rocket Man. So it was terrific. And we traveled the country promoting this film. That wouldn't have happened this year because nobody's traveling and, you know, nobody's packing into theaters. But I do hope people see the movie.
You've seen so much change over the years in terms of LGBTQ acceptance. Movies like 5B and even Rocket Man being one after the other, like you mentioned, on the red carpet, might not have happened decades ago.
Oh, no, absolutely not. And, you know, there's still a long way to go. I mean, you know, we still have, people don't know this, I think, we still have 13,000 people a year dying from HIV. I mean, people think it's over. It's not over. The therapeutics are wonderful, of course. The drugs are wonderful. Also, I would caution people to learn one of the lessons that we learned back then, which is there was so much false hope. There was so much promise of a vaccine. I remember Margaret Heckler, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, she announced in April of 1984 that we would have an AIDS vaccine within a year. Well, we're still waiting for that. So when you see these promises of a vaccine for COVID, just take this with a grain of salt. Viruses will dictate the schedule. We don't dictate the schedule. So there are a lot of lessons to be learned from back then.
There's a lot of viruses that fall into that camp. Herpes, HIV.
Right.
There are even chicken pox. You know, you have the initial condition, and then years and decades later, you might have painful shingles as a result of that virus. So we just don't know the long-term ramifications of COVID-19 at this point. And it is worth cautioning, based on the experience with the AIDS generation, that maybe a vaccine is not right around the corner.
Right, right. So I noticed the government just paid Pfizer $2 billion. That was in the Times today for their quote unquote vaccine. We don't even know if there is a vaccine. So I take all these stories very, very cautiously until we get some results. And also, I am afraid that the government, particularly this administration and the White House, is going to rush a vaccine candidate because they want something out there. And they'd love to have it out there before Election Day. And they'd love to have it out there before the end of the year. And let's just make sure that it works before we give people false hope and squander a lot of research time.
Mm-hmm. Multi-award winning journalist and currently on-air political analyst for NBC Palm Springs, Hank Plant. Hank, thank you so much for taking time this morning.
My pleasure, Randall. It's wonderful to catch up again.
Likewise. Still ahead, we're continuing our discussion of COVID-19 and how different generations are being affected. Washington Post reporter Tara Barampour talks about how some in the elderly population are making pandemic decisions that are concerning to their adult children. And writer Courtney Rubin joins us to talk about her New York Times piece that explains dating during the pandemic and how to do that safely. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. We're continuing the conversation on how different generations are affected and react, really, to the COVID-19 pandemic. With us now to talk about how seniors are affecting their adult kids is Washington Post reporter Tara Barampour. Welcome to Insight.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I appreciate you being here because I know you are concurrently covering a trial remotely. And so I appreciate you taking this sliver of time to speak with the CAP Radio listeners. Hey, what are some of the activities seniors are partaking in that are making their adult children really, in some cases, fear for their parents' lives?
They are hosting bridge parties. They are going to the barber and getting their hair cut. They are playing bocce together. They are going to aqua aerobics, activities like they were doing before the pandemic.
Yeah, and I know just in my own family, my sister and myself, you know, monitoring what my mom is doing. And there have been times we've placed a call and said, maybe don't do that. Are you finding this is causing any family tensions?
A lot of family tensions. Now, to be clear, not all older people are doing this, but there are quite a few people in their 80s and 90s who are being much more relaxed about the whole self-isolation, social distancing thing than their kids who are middle-aged. And the kids are in a particularly hard spot because they themselves in their 50s and 60s are somewhat vulnerable. They also may have their own children who are going to protests, who are going to the beach. And so they are trying to sort of triangulate between these two generations who are both misbehaving in different ways.
What might be driving this in the older population?
So there are a couple of things. In some cases, it seems to be that there is a bit of a political sway to it. Older people are more likely to follow conservative media and to listen to some of the messages that have been given out, in the sense of it not being as serious as the scientists are saying. But also, after age 80, studies have shown that people tend to take a different approach to risk and to sort of like risk and benefit analysis in terms of how they want to continue their life.
Right. So a view such as, hey, the clock is ticking and we don't know how long this virus is going to be around. I don't want the last couple of years of my life to be in isolation.
Exactly. And also, they are aware that for their own mental and physical health, they need to get out, they need to exercise, they need to have a social life. You know, many studies have shown that isolation is bad for people. And so they are weighing, you know, the what they're giving up by staying inside versus, you know, going out. And many of the ones that I talk to feel that they are being careful. They don't say, oh, there's no virus out there, I don't need to worry. It's just that their level of being careful is different from their kids.
Mm-hmm. How hard do you think children should push back if they see their parents engaged in what they would deem unsafe behavior?
I think it depends on what they're doing and also what the situation is. Like one child that I talked to, a child in her 50s, actually lives with her parents, and she herself is compromised. Her health is compromised. And so for somebody like that, I think she has a bit more of a case to make with her parents that they need to be more careful. But if you're living far away, or if your parents are willing to, you know, say, okay, well, we're going to see less of our children close up, but we're going to do these other things, then that's a decision that, you know, they are making, and children on various levels are accepting of that. What I found was interesting was the sense that people in their 50s and 60s, according to experts on aging, are much more invested still in the idea of prolonging their lives. Whereas people after age 80, they don't, it's not that they feel invulnerable, it's the opposite. It's that they sort of realize that they're not going to live forever. They're not immortal. And so their decisions take a different timber, I guess, or mm-hmm. tin.
Yeah. They're just different considerations, I guess. We're listening to, or you're hearing from Washington Post reporter Tara Barampour, who wrote an article about the interaction between adult children and their elderly parents during the pandemic and how some of the actions by the elderly parents might cause concern. How widespread would you say this is? Are they isolated incidents where this is happening, or is it, you know, pretty across the board?
It seems to be pretty across the board, both in terms of my reporting, but also the reaction and response that I got after the story ran. I got many, many emails and messages from people who said, yeah, this is happening with my parents. This is exactly it. And it seemed to be a story that was widely shared.
Yeah.
So I think it's nerve.
Circumstantially, I can agree. So, Tara Barampour with The Washington Post, thank you so much. And we should mention you can find Tara's piece on elderly parents, in some cases, behaving badly, linked on Cap Radio's Insight page. Thank you again.
Thanks so much.
And finally today, as part of our big conversation, dating during a pandemic. Now, while you can date at just about any age, this aspect likely affects more of you that are in your 20s and 30s. Are there safe ways to go about it right now? You know, some have done Zoom or FaceTime dates, while others have taken COVID-19 tests in order to prove they are virus-free before meeting a prospective partner in person. Freelance writer Courtney Rubin explored the topic in a recent New York Times article, and she's here to talk about what she learned. Courtney, great to have you with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
This conversation comes up in the newsroom quite a bit, and I'm wondering, how does someone date during a time when what we would consider normal activities are just not an option for meeting up?
I think the answer is very carefully. You know, obviously,
right.
There are lots of people doing Zoom dates, and actually, I do know a lot of people who actually like the idea of Zoom dates as a kind of elimination. You know, a friend of mine went on one, and she said she went on a regular date, and she said, I wish I'd gone on a Zoom date because I would have known in 5 minutes that, you know, this wasn't worth the whole masking up. But, you know, the other option is, you know, something outdoors, masked up, lots and lots of people. I think the thing I heard most repeatedly was that people were taking socially distanced walks, which sounds, you know, a little bit quaint, I guess.
Right. So you're in New York where the pandemic surged early. And I imagine a lot of the people of dating age in that city probably take this far more seriously than you might find in other parts of the country. Is it regional at all when it comes to dating practices right now?
You know, I think I spoke to actually a lot of people across the country, and I do think it's a bit regional. There are, I think in some ways it actually depends on how hard it is actually to get a coronavirus test where you are, because there are people who insist they do not want to meet up until they see a screen grab of someone's coronavirus test results. And obviously, in certain cases, it's in certain areas, it's just not really even possible to get a test at this point, or it takes a lot of effort.
Yeah, and then you have to have the whole conversation about what did you do after you had the test, because we know the tests aren't coming back for several days. And so it's just those tests are a moment in time. They were negative when the swab was taken, you know, but did they go to a party after that? You know, I guess that conversation has to happen.
No, totally. I mean, one of the things that I found the most surprising that actually didn't make it into the story was, you know, just to show what people are doing, you know, sales of at-home tests for sexually transmitted diseases are up like 500-something%. So, you know, there are people running around in this time.
So people want to know more than just whether they have COVID-19.
Right, yeah. Or, you know, they're taking actions that make them wonder.
Right, right. So apps, of course, were a big thing prior to the pandemic. I'm wondering, have any apps sort of moved out, dating apps moved out in front during this period because they might offer some, you know, different ways to screen your potential partner?
I think it's hard to say whether one has moved out in front or not. I think if you talk to different populations, there's always going to be a different app kind of in vogue. You know, some people like Tinder, some people like Hinge, some people like, you know, all of these various apps. And so Bumble, I believe, has, you know, badges that let you indicate like what kind of date you're up for. Are you up for a socially distanced date? Are you up for, you know, only a Zoom date? And so some of the apps, have started to do things like that. And then there's apps that have kind of more free-form profiles where people are just indicating their test results in their profiles.
It's right there when you're doing the swiping, huh?
I mean, it sounds like really crazy. I mean, if you think about it, you know, the amount of information that you now have to ask someone before you go on a date with them, like every banal interaction. I mean, when would you ever ask someone before you went on a first date with them, every person they had shared air with in the past 2 weeks?
Right. And are you a mask wearer or are you not?
Yeah. I mean, actually, I thought one of the guys that I talked to had a pretty elegant way that he admitted he stole from a woman who asked him it. He would say to people, you know, what does social distancing mean to you? And kind of get all the information he wanted about how they felt about masks.
Interesting. Right. So do you have any tips for how you can bring up your comfort level on meeting up in person with someone?
Yeah, I mean, I think that almost anything goes at the moment. And so I think the idea is that you just need to be kind of clear about it. You know, I think that most of the people, I think people are actually more forgiving during this time. So, you know, does it need to be the most elegantly worded thing? I don't think so. Everyone I spoke to said that they were more forgiving of quote unquote weird behavior because nobody was used to being around anyone anymore. So I think you can kind of just say what you feel like. And you know, and then see what the reaction is. I mean, do you want to bring that up in the first interaction, you know, in the first email? Probably not. But if you've moved on to Zoom talking, I imagine that you can just make it clear that you are not comfortable actually leaving your house and meeting them.
Let's talk a little bit about catfishing. That's when you pretend to be something you're not. In some cases, you know, it might be a more flattering picture or, you know, even a gender that's not yours. But I imagine in this case, people might catfish and you know, come across as I'm super safe in these pandemic times and might not be.
Sure. I mean, that's a huge issue is that, you know, that whole sort of thing on the internet, no one knows you're a dog. I mean, nobody really knows how, I guess, dogged you're being about any kind of coronavirus precaution here. Like, it's just, you know, in my story, there was, you know, a woman who spent a month talking to a guy on FaceTime. She said he was great. He was interested in what she had to say. He seemed interested in something serious. And then she went over to his backyard for a socially distanced date and everything was going really well. And then he takes her hand, you know, looks into her eyes and says, you know, if you consider losing 15 pounds, I'd consider leaving my girlfriend for you.
Oof.
And obviously he'd never mentioned this woman.
Right.
So
when I read that, Courtney, it was just like a punch in the stomach. I was like, that is just, that's awful.
I mean, it was horrible. She has a wonderful sense of humor and was kind of found the whole thing kind of funny, but it was scary, I think, for her to think, oh my God, I now need a coronavirus test.
Right, because there were some drinks, you know, flowing, and that's the one thing that we've, you know, heard about with the shutting down of bars and that sort of thing is a little bit of alcohol, and suddenly your personal space bubble shrinks. And that was happening in this case.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, actually, that's probably the one thing for dating, like the one big thing is if you are really worried about this, do not meet anyone for an alcoholic drink, even if it's outside, because, you know, your boundaries obviously change after one drink or, you know, depending on who you are, a couple of drinks. And so, you know, there were a lot of people that said to me that they didn't dare have a drink with someone at this point.
Boy, that really is a switch up in dating, you know.
I know. No Dutch courage, yes.
Wow. Hey, I'm wondering, as part of your process for writing this piece, how did you find these people who were willing to share their dating stories, good and bad, and in the case that we just heard, bad?
You know, it's really funny. I thought, I was really worried because it started out being enormously difficult, and I got some really great stories that I have to say are not of the standard that you could share in a family newspaper and also didn't have names attached to them. So I didn't want to use them because they would seem, you know, it would be like, did she make this up? So I really had to like work hard to find, you know, these people. And I stumbled on an Instagram. I mean, for the woman who told me about the horror story, she didn't tweet about it or anything, or, you know, Instagram about it, but I don't know, somehow I stumbled on her Instagram and she made some reference to having been on a date. She didn't say if it was good or bad, but I was like, oh, someone going on a date, I'll reach out to her. So, I mean, that's how I got that story, was just dumb luck.
And it ended up being a really just fascinating one to, you know, you in a way, you could just put yourself in that person's shoes. And, I, you know, so this show has been about generations. And I'm wondering, for at least for your reporting, did you find that most people were in their 20s and 30s? Or are people COVID dating at all ages?
You know what? They're COVID dating at all ages. I actually spoke to one woman who didn't want to give her name, who was in her 60s, and she said the biggest problem with dating at her age was that no one can hear, and you're also wearing masks.
Oh, right. So you have to get moving closer. Okay. Freelance writer Courtney Rubin explored the topic of dating in a recent New York Times article. Courtney's piece is available at gapradio.org on the Insight page. Courtney, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been really fun.
A quick programming note. Governor Gavin Newsom will hold another press conference today at noon to update us all on the state's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. And you'll hear that live here, of course, on Cap Radio. That's Insight for today. A big thank you to our engineer, Devin Cortan, producers Kyle McKinnon and Cynthia Lopez. And a big thank you to you for being with us today. We'll catch you again tomorrow. So that's today's deep dive look into one single topic from several different perspectives. Now for an in-depth conversation regarding the news of the day. Coronavirus hospitalization numbers are skyrocketing in San Joaquin County, so we want to check in briefly with Cap Radio's Rich Ibarra, who covers Stockton, Modesto, and the Central Valley for us. Rich, thanks for taking the time to update the Insight audience this morning.
Good morning, Randall.
The issue here really is ICU beds, the number of people being treated in the intensive care units, right?
That's right. In fact, it's been so bad in this area that as of last week, we had two federal teams, Air Force teams, that came to two different hospitals. One was Dameron Hospital in Stockton. The other was in Lodi Memorial Hospital. There are about 20 medical personnel, which include physicians, nurse practitioners, respiratory therapists who have come to help staff for ICU beds, because although they may have the beds, they don't have the staff to make those beds available and to care for those patients.
Yeah, we're looking at 138% of ICU capacity, which is clearly above what can be handled. Governor Gavin Newsom and the state monitors counties, and when some have risen in, have a rise rather in new cases amid other factors over a number of days, the county gets put on a watch list. When the number of available ICU beds drops below 20%, that's a problem. And in this case, San Joaquin County, Rich, is in really worrisome territory.
That's right. In fact, we have a number of ICU beds in use is 137 beds, which makes it 138% of capacity. When you look at the numbers, though, too, as far as the people who are occupying those beds, 73 of the 137 beds are COVID-19 patients. So that's over half. Mm.
The Central Valley in general is seeing a spike in cases higher than most of the state. In fact, the highest currently on the state's website is Stanislaus County with 346 people per 100,000, with a high testing positivity rate too, about 17%, while San Joaquin County is at 13%, which is still very high. Merced is nearly 15%. Just for comparison, Sacramento is at 8%. Rich, what do you think is driving these higher numbers in the region?
Well, I think it's a combination of reopening. And when you had the reopening, one thing that the Stockton City Council tried to do was to pass a mandate that everybody had to wear masks going into stores and being on the outside, social distancing, et cetera. Mayor Tubbs is the one that proposed the ordinance, but it was voted down by every other member of the council except for Tubbs. And I think in some respects, when you talk about masking or not masking, I think it has a lot to do with spreading the infection. And even now with the state mandate in place, you still see people at stores, although not as many, not wearing a mask.
Cap Radio's Rich Ibarra on the current spike in COVID-19 ICU hospitalizations in the Central Valley. Thank you, Rich, for joining us today.
Thank you.